poesía.
Hello and welcome to The Wire, your independent and Indigenous current affairs across Australia on community radio. I'm Elizabeth Neal from our studios at 4EB in Brisbane. Today on the show...
The old system had not fully protected either the guests or the staff.
The Victorian government resumed its hotel quarantine system this week, but would it be successful this time? Also, another media commentary sparked controversy about crime and cold communities. What can we do to stop fueling racism? And later today...
Emissions are reducing in nearly every sector except transport, where they're going up. Emissions have gone up by about 18% since 1990, and that's only likely to increase.
Advocacy groups are lobbying the Victorian government to increase electric cars to reach a zero carbon emission. We found out if it's realistic. We'll have this and more for you over the next hour. Thanks for joining us today. We're on air across Australia through the Community Radio Network and support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Coming up first, our neighbours in Timor-Leste are experiencing the worst floods in 50 years, displacing many families while managing their COVID outbreaks. Care Australia is on the ground helping the government and community after this natural disaster. The Wire's Eduardo Jordan spoke with Humanitarian Coordinator at Care Australia, Samantha Orr, and started asking her how dire the issue is in Timor-Leste.
So the flooding that's taken place over the past week has been some of the worst that we've seen in 50 years. It's particularly affected the capital city of Dili, but also people who are living close to rivers or in low-lying areas. Also other population centres like VKK have also been significantly affected by floods.
How many people and families have been placed into accommodation shelters so far, and how many more are expected to be in these shelters?
So the figures are still coming in, and I think they will increase over the coming days, but currently the information that we have is that more than 10,000 people have been significantly affected, and that there are over 9,500 people in 18 emergency evacuation centres around the city of Dili.
With the recent outbreaks of COVID there, I understand there were some outbreaks in Timor-Leste. How difficult has it been to displace the families into shelter accommodation, and how are people on the ground trying to solve the issue?
COVID is a significant concern for everybody. There was increasing cases before the flood, so they were in the beginning of an outbreak in early March, and so figures had been increasing significantly in that month. Obviously, the flooding has complicated that, particularly with people living in close quarters in emergency evacuation centres. We are supporting the government in trying to ensure that people are able to maximise social distancing practices in those centres, and also making sure that people have access to masks and hand sanitiser so that they're able to protect themselves while they're staying in these temporary shelters.
What is the people from Care Australia telling you about the situation there? How do they look at it?
So the situation is pretty grave, both from a flooding perspective, but then also the complication of increased COVID cases, but also the risk of that to continue to increase. A number of our staff have also been affected themselves. They've had their home flooded as well. So it's a big issue because all of Dili has been affected. Everybody who lives in the city has been affected to some extent. And so it's trying to work with the government and with other civil society organisations to provide help to those that are the most affected. Obviously, for Care, we're particularly concerned about women and children who are 14 times more at risk of death and injury in these types of disasters, to make sure that they're also getting what they need as well. Obviously, what we're hearing from our colleagues in country is that some of the most immediate needs are that people need access to food, they need to have clothing, and also somewhere safe to sleep at night. For us, we are trying to work with the government in those evacuation centres to make sure that people have access to places to sleep, clothing, food, but also some of that COVID equipment or supplies. But also then, as we go forward, to make sure that people have the ability to go back and reconstruct or to fix their homes, so they're able to go back to their homes as soon as possible.
Now, how can people help out, and where can we get more information about the things Care Australia is doing on the ground in Timor-Leste?
So our staff on the ground are working with the government and with civil society to understand what people's needs are. So we're doing assessments in order to understand where we can provide support. For people that are interested, I would direct them to our website at care.org.au, where we have more information about the flooding, but also how people can support if they want. It's important that we're supporting also local organisations who work directly in the village. As we get more of an understanding of what people need to be able to go back to their lives, that we're also supporting those organisations and also the government in terms of what they see as the priorities for who've been affected. I would invite people to go to our website, because there's more information there, both on the floods and also how people can support in helping people to recover their lives.
That was Humanitarian Coordinator at Care Australia, Samantha Orr, speaking with Eduardo Jordan. For more information about the issue, you can head to our website, thewire.org.au.
A different take on Australian current affairs. This is The Wire on your community radio.
The Victorian government has updated their hotel quarantine scheme for the third time, with the state allowing international travellers back into Melbourne as of yesterday. But will the changes be enough to keep residents safe? This is the third time the government has updated their scheme after a second wave of the virus back in June last year and a recent hotel cluster in February, leading to a five-day lockdown. Yesterday, an expected 106 international travellers arrived in Melbourne and were taken to the Intercontinental Hotel in the CBD. According to COVID-19 Quarantine Victoria, the limit on international travellers into the state will be capped at 800 people in this first week, and is then expected to expand to 1,000 as more quarantine hotels are approved for use. Currently, there are 6 hotels accommodating international return travellers, including several in Melbourne's CBD. These include the Intercontinental, Novotel Ibis Melbourne Central, Holiday Inn on Flinders, and Element Melbourne Richmond. The Pan Pacific Hotel will also be a designated location for airline crew, and the Holiday Inn at Melbourne Airport is also accommodating for international return travellers, despite being the epicentre of a cluster leading to the five-day lockdown back in February. The updated hotel quarantine scheme reflects concerns from the government after the previous failings of the system, which included the threat of airborne transmission. Airborne transmission has since been identified as the cause of the previous breaches of hotel quarantine seen in 2 separate clusters from hotels in Melbourne. Epidemiologist for the Burnet Institute, Professor Mike Toole, says previous incarnations of the hotel quarantine system failed to keep staff and travellers safe from airborne transmission, but the updated measures will mean airborne transmission is far less likely.
So the new system has addressed that by having done a thorough room-by-room assessment of ventilation. They've done that and completed it in 6 hotels, and they have they're still doing it in 6 other hotels. In every room, there is what we call negative pressure. So when a guest opens the door into the hallway, the air from the hallway goes into the room rather than out.
CQV Commissioner Emma Kassar says the agency is confident in the update to the ventilation system.
We're really confident in those rooms that are negatively pressured.
As well as the introduction of negative pressure in hotel ventilation systems, the updated scheme also requires hotel staff to wear personal protective equipment in line with health and complex care practices. Staff who work in areas of hotels which put them at risk of exposure will be supplied with N95 respiratory masks. All staff will also be required to be vaccinated with at least one dose of the Pfizer vaccine or risk being redeployed elsewhere. Speaking to Nine News on Wednesday, Opposition Leader Michael O'Brien voiced his concerns over the efficiency of the updated scheme.
I'm nervous. I think all Victorians are nervous because the government's got it wrong twice in the past. And when the government gets hotel quarantine wrong, they throw us into lockdown.
But Professor Toole says this updated system leaves very little room for risk of transmission, despite the previous attempts at a hotel quarantine system.
Look, I think no system is absolute 100% effective. But I think the risk in this new system in Victoria is very, very low. I think they've basically plugged the holes that were in the old system.
He says the only concern he has is with other states such as Queensland and Western Australia not adopting the same measures as Victoria, risking the health of staff and potentially causing another outbreak.
Those new measures have not been adopted. So there is a risk, I think a higher risk, so in Perth, Sydney and Brisbane, of continuing to have staff being infected.
Queensland was recently placed under its second three-day snap lockdown after a cluster was discovered from the Princess Alexandra Hospital in Brisbane. The hospital itself was also placed into lockdown. Professor Toole says Victoria's new imposed hotel quarantine scheme presents a golden opportunity for the rest of the country to follow in the state's footsteps and ensure zero transmission from travellers while in quarantine.
The first step would be for the heads of each state and territory quarantine program to share their experience and do it every week. You know, the chief health officers do that, but I'm not aware of the quarantine officers doing the same. Now, in the process, they could develop a consensus on what is the best code of conduct, code of practice, and they could all voluntarily agree to that.
He says this will avoid any unnecessary bureaucracy from the federal government and ensure the development of the best practice guidelines.
And I think it's in the country's interest to make those guidelines standard across the country. You know, some people have said, oh, developing a national protocol would take months and months. I don't think that's necessarily the case. I think it can be done in a much more straightforward manner through consensus. And I think it's about time. I don't think it's fair that in some states, returning travellers are going into an environment that is higher risk than other states.
Tune into The Wire on your local station and catch up with what's making the world tick. Covering local, national and international stories with fresh perspectives and new voices. Plug into The Wire, independent current affairs, coming up on your community radio station.
An Infrastructure Victoria panel has backed the ban of petrol car sales by the year 2030 in a bid to raise electric vehicle sales. Vehicle emissions are one of Australia's biggest setbacks in reaching the 2050 goal of net zero carbon emissions. The Wire's Alyssa Napier reports.
Electric car sales make up for just 0.6% of Australia's vehicle sales and will need to be raised to at least 50% within 10 years to remain on target. Infrastructure Victoria will present their 30-year strategy report to Parliament later this year, along with the panel's findings and suggestions to accelerate the uptake of electric vehicles over petrol. Deputy Chief Executive and Chief Operating Officer of Infrastructure Victoria, Dr. Jonathan Spears, says the panel highlighted three points to be addressed.
There were three main things. So the first one was that the price of electric vehicles relative to petrol and diesel cars is higher. And until that comes down, which is expected to be in a few years' time, some help with the upfront costs of electric vehicles would be helpful. So the second thing that the community panel told us was that better information about how electric vehicles work and what they cost would be really useful, because there's lots of myths and legends about this. That's something that's holding people back, is that uncertainty and that lack of knowledge about how they operate.
The third point relies heavily on accessibility for both the purchase and use of electric vehicles.
The third thing that the community panel told us was there's a real need to have confidence that you can charge your electric car when you need to. And so some of that will happen at home or in workplaces. It's continuing to deploy public charging stations is something that people would value. So it's those three things. And then the current lack of choice of different electric vehicle types in the market is something that might also be helped if we were to set a date that everyone's clear that we're working to, that we're not going to sell new petrol and diesel cars, because that means that the international manufacturers of these vehicles know that they're going to need to start bringing in a wider range of cars to Australia.
He says vehicle emissions are likely to grow and the uptake of electric vehicles has substantial benefits.
If we do not move to electric vehicles more rapidly than we are now, we're not going to meet climate change reduction targets. So, for example, in Victoria, emissions have gone up by about 18% since 1990, and that's only likely to increase as our population and journeys increase. So that was something that the community panel thought we should be bringing awareness of, as well as the human health benefits, because we've done work in the past that identifies that it's those particles that come out of petrol and diesel exhausts do cause human health damage. So there's really big benefits to meeting climate change reductions, to improving human health, but also to our pockets, because electric vehicles are cheaper to run. And so those are some of the things that the community panel thought there should be much greater awareness of.
Sustainable Economics Lead for Climate Works Australia, Rupert Posner, says Australia's electric car sales are stunted by a lack of incentives.
Australia has a really low uptake of electric vehicles and well behind many other countries around the world. One of the reasons is because the manufacturers of electric vehicles are providing those vehicles in markets that are providing incentives for consumers to take them up. And there are very few incentives for consumers in Australia to take up electric vehicles. I'm optimistic that the Infrastructure Victoria report that gets presented to government will encourage the government to put many more incentives to encourage the take up of electric vehicles, because we need it. Otherwise, Victoria won't meet its goal of decarbonising the economy by 2050.
Mr. Posner says the panel's suggestion to have a community education program would help in debunking the myths surrounding electric vehicles.
There are quite a lot of myths that are out there about how electric vehicles work, and we find that people who use electric vehicles find that they are not true. For example, some people are concerned about something called range anxiety, which means that they won't be able to travel as far as they need on electric vehicle. You know, current electric vehicles can do hundreds, sometimes up to 500 kilometres on a charge, and the average person does less than 30 kilometres in a day. So the issues that are there are generally not well founded. Interestingly, the panel suggested that a community education program would be a good idea, so that people understand the benefits as well as debunking some of those myths.
He says Australia's 2050 carbon emissions goal is reachable if the country acts immediately.
It is absolutely achievable, but not only is it achievable, it's also imperative that we do it. And this decade needs to be the decade of action. So we've got to stop delaying action and get on with things and do it at pace. So yes, we can absolutely do it, and we need to do it, but we can only do it if we get on and we implement some really strong measures very quickly.
That was Sustainable Economics Lead for Climate Works Australia, Rupert Posner, speaking with The Wire's Alyssa Napier. Recent comments on the media have sparked concerns amongst the culturally and linguistically diverse community. A comment made yesterday linking culture with incarceration has affected the African Australian community in Victoria. The Wire's Eduardo Jordan spoke with Chief Executive of Settlement Services International, Violet Rumeliotis, and started asking her what her organisation is about.
Well, SSI is a community organisation, a not-for-profit, and we work with newly arrived refugees, asylum seekers, skilled migrants, anyone on any visa type, and other Australians to achieve their full potential. So we work with people who might have a vulnerability. It could be people with disabilities, people looking for work, people suffering from family or domestic violence. Our main purpose is to achieve a society that really values the diversity of its people and really actively provides support to ensure that they can engage socially, economically and culturally.
Could you please expand a bit more about the situation with the comments made about the African community in Victoria?
Well, commentary was released yesterday, which highlighted that culture is the reason that African youth comprise 19% of young people in custody in Victoria, despite the saying accounting for less than 0.5% of Victoria's youth population. And these statistics themselves stem from recent research from Australian academic Dr. Shepherd, which importantly showed no evidence to suggest that culture was responsible for this overrepresentation. And it is concerning to see research selectively republished in this way. We know that public commentary has a trickle-down effect into our communities. We saw what happened a few years ago when, again, this issue of African gang crime flared up in Victoria. As Dr. Shepherd himself has said, culture isn't a risk factor for youth incarceration, and he actually underscores that the risk factors include things such as exposure, early exposure to crime, neglect and poor parental attachment. And I, in the past, have worked in the criminal justice area, and I can tell you that it is not one culture or one religion or one gender that is criminal. There are factors that lead to people behaving in ways that society considers criminal.
What are some of the consequences of saying that culture is a fact of incarceration when it's really not?
Well, it is concerning to see commentary linking culture with crime when there's no evidence to support this. And as I said earlier, we saw a few years ago the wave of media coverage around African gang crime, and you know, which, and that actually led to racially motivated threats against members of the African community. And you know, it is shocking. And we know that comments like this can lead not only just to an increase in threats to people around violence and assaults to the African community, but it causes more and more disruption and division within, you know, our neighbourhoods and our communities. And I think one of our greatest strengths as a country is our multicultural makeup. And there is one, and that is one of the reasons why it's discouraging to see sort of misguided attitudes are still present in Australia.
Why do you believe the media has a responsibility, not on treating carefully these topics, but more on showing the facts, particularly speaking on the culturally and linguistically diverse communities?
Well, we need media to tread carefully, not to inflame views expressed in opinion pieces, especially when they're not based in evidence. Of course, there's no denying that media plays a critical role, and they do have the ability to shift public opinion, to spread information, you know, based on evidence, and to spread misinformation. You know, this has been quite evident over the years, and very important for us, the role of media, for example, and culture and linguistically diverse communities over the past 12 months with COVID-19, where media played a really important role in being able to provide information to communities in language and in appropriate fora and in the way, you know, that are going to be relevant for the different communities and how they like to receive information. But we also saw how it could inflame racial, you know, could vilify people racially and inflame sort of racist attacks. Again, in Victoria, we saw when the lockdown of those buildings, and there was very much a commentary that it was coming from the communities that lived in that building, and somehow that they were more of a health danger than the mainstream. So I think it's really important that organisations like SSI put our voice to calls, you know, to counter racist attitudes, both asking government to invest in anti-racism programs and initiatives, but also to look at ways where we can work with the media to highlight positives in multicultural Australia.
Chief Executive of Settlement Services International, Violet Romiliotis there, speaking with The Wire's Eduardo Jordan. And unfortunately, that's the end of the show today. Thanks so much for listening wherever you are in Australia. The Wire is a co-production between community radio stations 2SER in Sydney, Radio Adelaide and Radio 4EB in Brisbane, with the great support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation and the Community Radio Network. We'll see you next week, same time, on your local station. If you would like to listen to any of our stories again, you can go to our website, www.thewire.org.au. Also, you can listen to us on your favourite podcast service. Get in touch with us on social media. Just search for The Wire Radio, all one word, on Twitter. Or search us on Facebook at The Wire, independent current affairs on radio around Australia. Give us a like, a comment, and share with us what stories you would like to hear. The Wire acknowledges the traditional owners of the Yuggera land where this program has been produced, and we pay our respects to the Aboriginal elders, past, present, and emerging. Today, The Wire came to you from our studios at Radio 4EB in Brisbane. I'm Elizabeth Neal. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll hear you next time on The Wire.
long.